From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 2 weeks ago when President Trump addressed the National NRA Convention. The president promised to fight for gun rights for all Americans, and the NRA took that as a rallying cry. Now, interestingly, especially depending on who you talk to, Trump's election could make new gun legislation, and I mean new, a little more restrictive gun legislation, more possible. At least that is the view of some who are associated with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. They've released their new legislative priorities, including efforts to protect women who are far more likely to be victimized by gun violence in domestic situations. And American women are 11 times more likely to be victims of violence than women in other developed countries, often because of guns. So let's talk about those priorities and what new legislation would mean. My guests for the hour include Gary Putup from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Gary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And also here is Pam Graham, who is a prevention, education, and training manager at Willow Domestic Violence Center. Pam, welcome back to the program to you as well.
Thanks so much.
Well, Gary, I'm going to start with you. You know, this whole question on what's more likely here. A lot of people see the president talking to the NRA. There's a Republican Congress nationally. We're going to talk about state priorities. But right now, just let's look at whether it's federally, whether it's in New York State. Do you think this window is open to actually do more when it comes to gun law, even though Donald Trump was elected?
I think in some selected areas, yes, it does. And I think especially like in New York, it does. Last week, there were members in the New York State Senate that were finally moved to hold a press conference and propose a package of gun regulation. And these are laws, bills, and proposals that the New York State Senate was reluctant to do in the past. And they were very forthright that one of the reasons was that they see on a national or a federal level a loosening, and they're concerned that if that affected New York State, you know, our gun death rate would go up again, which since the passage of the SAFE Act has gone down. Things are good in New York. So in a backhanded kind of way, this is New York State's response to some of the stuff that the president talked about, some of the things that the president talked about before the National Rifle Association.
So this goes back to the theme that we've heard in many conversations just this year, which is there's going to be national conversations and national priorities, but you're going to see states and sometimes even municipalities acting locally, sometimes to counter what we're seeing on the national level. So perhaps we're moving in that direction. And Gary, there's a number of prongs on the priority list for New Yorkers Against Gun Violence when it comes to legislative priorities this year. And I want to start at the top. You wrote a short piece for City Newspaper recently. You've been talking about these issues as they pertain, to all citizens, but to women in particular. I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Gary. What's the message when it comes to gun violence and the impact on women that you guys are looking at for legislative priorities?
Well, one of the things that really concerns us, and it should concern everyone, is the particular circumstance that women face with gun violence. In the United States, as you mentioned earlier, in the United States, women are 11 times more likely to be killed in a domestic violence situation than they are in other developed nations. And there's one factor that is common to these homicides, and that's the use of a firearm. And part of the problem is it's too easy to access a firearm and it's too easy to keep a firearm when the situation is such that an abuser really needs to the firearms really need to be kept from the access of abusers. This is one of the reasons why we are supporting one proposal before the legislature, and that's called the Extreme Risk Protection Order. The Extreme Risk Protection Order, by the way, is a proactive. Basically, it follows the same thinking as an order of protection. The problem with orders of protection is that they're generally reactive. Well, they are reactive. You know, someone has a problem. And I'm going to just use women because women are the majority of the victims of domestic abuse. There are men that are abused domestically, but the majority are women, and women are more vulnerable in these situations. That when they call the police or the courts get involved, the court can then issue an order of protection. But that's reactive. And very often we have situations where family members, other household members, may be seeing a pattern of behavior on the part of someone that owns a gun. And that endangers the woman's life, the victim's life. And what this order would do, it would allow family members and household members to present articulable evidence, sworn evidence, before a judge who can petition a court. It would have judicial review. And the judge could order what would be called a temporary extreme risk protection order that would take the guns for safekeeping, not confiscate, and it's an important difference, but would take the guns for safekeeping. When the situation is passed, the respondent, the person who owned the gun, could always petition the court to get them back. For instance, if it was a domestic violence situation, and perhaps maybe they're going through a divorce, and once the divorce is over, the person, you know, whose guns were taken for safekeeping, maybe will get them back. Although that raises some complicated issues with who the next victim is going to be, but at least it would prevent that. There's also a sunset clause in there that after a year's time, if there's no other issues, they would be able to get their firearms back. So there's judicial review. But really what this is doing is, so often we hear in these cases that no one was connecting the dots. And what this does is it connects the dots and provides for the safety of the woman.
All right, I've got some questions to follow up on that. But before we do that, let me ask Pam Graham from Willow Domestic Violence Center to weigh in on what you're hearing, not only with this proposal, but you're concerned about the way gun violence impacts women, Pam.
Well, it does. It really does. So if we look at dangerous relationships where dating domestic violence happens, we know that nothing bad starts to happen until after there's a commitment. And then once it starts, the more it happens, the worse it gets. So it depends on what that commitment is. The other thing about each dangerous relationship has its own lethality level based on the abusive intimate partner in it. And we were talking earlier and saying that what works over here for some abusive partners might actually escalate and get a survivor killed over here. So there's a few things that we know that provide greater risk. Strangulation. Has a strangulation happened in the past? What have been the threats in the past? See, because abusers gain the power and control with the threats, they maintain them by following through with those threats. Is there firearms in the house? What's the accessibility thing? So we know that all increases. So if we got domestic violence over here and then we've got guns over here, it's a really lethal combination. It's looking bad.
One thing that, Pam, you say often is that domestic violence is preventable.
100%. And it's 100% preventable.
Why do you say that?
We say that because we can't confuse people who are abusive with anger management. With anger management, that can be diagnosed, right? It can be re-educated. It can even be medicated. And even with anger management, the end of the day is the person who's in it has the choice on whether they're going to take care so they can regroup on the anger management piece. But people who are abusive tend to be beautiful, gorgeous people. They're out there in the world and nobody is going to know. We know people who are abusive choose to be abusive because they weave in the love and the goodness along with the tension and the abuse. Evan, if any of us here were abused 24/7, there wouldn't be a person in any of those relationships. And that's key. So we know people choose to be abusive, but we know they've learned it. So kids growing up in homes where they see one parent abusive to the others, they say males are more likely to be abusive themselves growing up in homes in it. They say young women growing up in homes where they see mom abused are 15 times more likely to be survivors themselves. So all this stuff about adverse childhood experiences and domestic violence being a part of that tells us that people are seeing, people are learning, and it's not going to be that obvious to any of us.
And anger management is not necessarily tied to someone who is abusive? How often are those things linked?
Often, because it's not unusual for judges to say, no, go to anger management. Mm-hmm. And then it's acting like it's an out of control thing. But people who are abusive are choosing to do it because, for instance, these aren't folks who are going and beating up a boss when they get told what to do, right? These are people who are ordering food in a restaurant and not beating up the waitress because the food is cold.
So they abuse for what? Control?
Power and control.
Power and control.
People who are abusive gain the power and control with the threats of, and then maintain it by following through with those threats.
And when it comes to preventing domestic violence and then, unfortunately, preventing homicide, preventing death in domestic violence situations, is it sometimes just a matter of a question. Is there a gun accessible here or not?
Yes.
And if there is, someone could die. And if there's not, that much less likely.
Yes. And actually, we work very closely at Willow using a danger assessment with survivors to start to figure out what's actually going on with it. And the danger assessment actually came from a Jacqueline Campbell, who's done years of study through Duluth and through, I believe, Johns Hopkins universities. And she started putting it together if we ask the right questions. Has there been a threat in the last 30 days? In the last year, have you attempted to escape? Is there a gun? Does your intimate partner have access to a gun? Have they ever used other weapons against you in the past? Has there been a strangulation? So when we look at the lethal behaviors of what's going on there, we can start to figure out and say to a survivor, what do you feel like you need in order to be safe right now? And to support that.
Okay. Listeners, if you've got any questions as we continue to talk about possible new gun legislation, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester, 263-9994. So, Gary, when it comes to this proposal on the extreme risk protection order, I want to go back to what the family could do when you called it. I think you said it was articulable. That's like the worst word.
I know.
Articulatable? I don't actually know what the word is.
It's hard to articulate.
It is. Evidence that can be articulated by family in court.
Yeah, it has to be.
But it's not just someone saying, I burned the toast and he yelled at me. You know, what are the standards here where a family member could say in court, this is happening and therefore you've got to take the firearms away from someone who legally currently has them? How do we create some kind of a standard that says, or is it at the discretion of a judge? How does it work?
Well, some of it's going to be a discretion of the judge because each case, like Pam said, each case is going to be different. But and to keep in mind, you know, I was involved in law enforcement for a long time. And one of the things that happened with orders of protection is there was always a criticism that in a domestic situation that the abused partner could just call law enforcement, could call the police and make something up that would get the person, you know, the suspect, so to speak, in trouble. And there may or may not have been cases of that. I would think in my career it was very rare, but that goes, you know, that it is thought to have been happened. What this does is it's more than just one person. It has to be based on some behavior. So, for instance, in your situation, the situation that you brought up, someone just yelling at somebody saying, well, you burnt the toast, isn't going to be enough. And it's only going to be one person. What the extreme risk protection order does, first of all, it's got to be more than one person, and it has to be based on some kind of behavior. So if let us say in this case the woman burnt the toast, is it just the husband yelling at her that he burnt the toast, or does he strike her, or does he threaten her and get into her face? You know, there was and we talked about this earlier. There's a sociologist that wrote a book called The Gift of Fear, Gavin DeBecker, and he put this, and I think he put this really, really well. He said, you know, at core, men are afraid women are going to laugh at them, but at the core, women are afraid that men are going to kill them. One of the things we talked about, and you mentioned that, and we all talk about the actual deaths that occur. But I think one of the things that we have to be aware of, too, is the fear that these women live in. And more women live in this fear than are actually killed. There was a study, and I believe it was out of Johns Hopkins Medical School, mm-hmm. that showed, you know, very often what happens is the abuser will use the gun as a means to intimidate the victim. And that's something that's really important, too. And, like, I think what we agree on here is you got to take that away from that individual. So when you talk about, like, what kind of evidence, you know, a family member, again, the victim, maybe a child, a parent, or in our case, we also say household members, so it would cover domestic partners and others that live in a household. If they went to a judge and say, I saw this person threaten, you know, the victim with a gun, or he has a gun and he mentioned, you know, he said, I'm going to go get the gun if you keep this up. And that's a very real fear that women live under. And again, so you have the judicial, you know, you have judicial review. So does that answer the question?
It does, though I'm now thinking of someone, Usually, as Gary said, usually a woman who's victimized, not always in these cases, but usually. Pam, how much more often are women victimized than men in domestic violence?
Well, actually, the newest stats are 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men. But what we're seeing is the most reported are actually females 16 through 24 okay. are at the groups that are highest risk.
Okay.
But again, you know, we're still in a place that, I mean, there's a reason why we need the Violence Against Women's Act. If we don't have equality, we're going to have power and control. If we got power and control, we already have trouble, especially when it comes to this dangerous stuff.
All right. So I'm thinking of someone who is being victimized, being threatened, maybe being abused, and is concerned that the person they are with who owns a gun is going to use it against them. But Gary, if you need more than one person, well, if you live alone, if you're just a childless couple living together, then the judge going to say, look, I need more than just your testimony on this? You know, how are you going to handle that situation?
Well, yeah, and I'm sorry I didn't mention this earlier. This also we're including family members, because in the past and in some states, you know, law enforcement, social workers, and others can also petition the court. So in this, I mentioned family members and household members because that's something new. And of course, in the past, if you had police officers, say, were called to a domestic trouble and they witnessed this, a police officer could go to a judge, you know, and ask for an order of protection. So say you had a situation where, you know, it is, one person's word against another. But if that person was, brave enough, and really it does take a certain amount of courage to call the police, these people, women, especially women that are in these situations. And I think one thing we have to make clear is, you know, women are vulnerable, but women aren't necessarily weak. And I think it's important to understand that when we talk about this and we talk about women, it's because they're vulnerable. It is not because they are weak. And that's part of the whole gender issue with guns and gun regulation. So there is that. Now, I would love to be able to say, could a victim just walk into a judge on her own and say, judge, this is how the person is treating me. This is what my fear is. And the judge would order a restraining order. I would like that. The problem is, we do have to balance this out with the person's civil liberties. You know, we have to be careful. It's not just one person's word against another. But we could, it could also be a situation where the victim has maybe some physical marks, maybe has been to an emergency room or a doctor with marks or, some other kind of physical evidence that a judge could take that into consideration. Is it a weakness, so to speak, in the law? Maybe, but again, and you've had me on enough to know that, we do have to be careful with the civil liberties, and we have to make sure that it isn't abused.
Okay. Pam, thoughts on that?
Yeah. So let's talk locally in Monroe County and Willow stuff. So there's two different ways people can get orders and protection, and one's through criminal court, right? So the police have come, they've said this is a problem, they're pressing charges, and then at the arraignment, correct, if the victim says, I need an order of protection, it's granted. There's also another way that people can apply for orders of protection, and that's to actually go through the family court process. And that's more of the civil piece, right? So yeah. A survivor chooses to go and apply for an order of protection, goes before a judge and says X, Y, and Z has been happening. And at that time, we should be assessing, saying, in the consideration of granting a stay-away order of protection, are there firearms in the house? And if so, they are temporarily removed, right?
Yes. And again, to be clear, but again, those are very often reactive.
Yes.
So they're in criminal court because the victim has suffered an injury.
And the family court, can the family court piece is more of an option based on the survivor, what they're deeming safest to do. So that's kind of like a food of thought here. So orders of protection, choosing to go and apply for an order of protection might not be safe for everybody because just the mere act of going might escalate it. So if a person goes, sits before a judge saying, this is what happened, I'm requesting a stay-away order of protection, and then just servicing that, because the next step is the abuser's coming into court and now we're both talking about it. Do you see how that is?
Yep.
So my concern about all of this, it's wonderful to start laying the foundation of further options and safety pillars we can put into place for survivors of dating domestic violence, male or female, right? Or within a family domestic setting. But we still need to really hear the voice of the survivor of what they deem safe at the moment. Because what's safe for a survivor here today might literally get them killed tomorrow. So we need to say, what do you feel like you need to be safe for today? And if they say, you just knowing, or that sounds good today, if they change their mind tomorrow, that we understand that whatever's going on there, they're deeming safest for that moment. So the expert lies in the survivor and not in all of us.
And it's important to understand that these things, and when we propose these, and we've said this before about, you know, when it deals with gun violence, there's different forms of gun violence, and not the same answer is going to work for everything. For instance,
absolutely,
there's crime, there's just like your street crime gun violence.
Yep.
You have your accidents and suicides, and you have these type of situations. So this is an option. One of the things that happened, and I guess we could be thankful in some backhanded again way to O.J. Simpson, is prior to a lot of the changes in the law after the Simpson case, was it in the past a police officer either had to actually witness, the police officer would have to actually have the victim sign a complaint.
Yeah.
And that was very difficult because the problem is
the danger level there.
The
is
danger
massive.
Level. Not everybody goes to jail and is kept in jail after they abuse their victim. They're released. And then, particularly in these cases, a woman has to worry that, you know, I have this person arrested, then they go to jail, and then they come back and they're going to abuse me. You know, it's going to be even worse. So the police were able to intercede. And, you know, of course, that could be an issue here. I think one of the things, too, with domestic violence is to keep in mind, too, that there's underlying causes for domestic violence. Maybe the person isn't necessarily an evil person. And we see this, you know, with some of our veterans, right, coming back from war where, you know, they're suffering from PTSD, severe cases of depression, and they have, you know, these issues, and they're taking it out on other family members. You know, and again, those are particularly dangerous situations.
And those are all part of actually the danger assessments that we work on. Have they ever threatened suicide? You know, is there any depression going on? That's all part of the danger assessments they do. Again, keeping in mind, if people were out of control, they would be abusive to everybody, not a specific few. So, the other food for thought here, too, is that nobody sees this coming. Again, we're so busy driving towards our happy ending that nobody really realizes people who are abusive are. They don't come up and say, after I'm done being your world's worst nightmare, Gary, this is going to be a good thing. That doesn't happen. People who are abusive are very strategic and very manipulative, even above and beyond any challenges they have.
All right, so when it comes to the extreme risk protection order, Gary made one other comment that I want to follow up on. You said if a court determines that there is a risk that the gun or guns could be put in safekeeping but not confiscated, some will say, well, that is a distinction without a difference. You're not confiscating? That's the same thing, isn't it, Gary?
Well, to us, confiscation would imply that being taken and that's like irrevocable.
Okay.
Your guns are taken, we're confiscating your guns, you're not getting them back.
All right.
You know, and the example people use there is, I guess, Australia, where they actually confiscated and destroyed guns.
Hundreds of thousands of guns.
This is a case where they're just being kept in safekeeping. And that is an important difference. I mean, even back in the police world, you know, when we take property in, there's the little checkbox. Is this being destroyed? Is it being kept as evidence? Is it just safekeeping? You know, they're just holding on to them till the crisis passed. And, you know, a crisis like this, unless, you know, if we relate it to domestic violence, it could be a situation where, you know, the abuser needs help.
Yeah.
Maybe they have a medical problem. Maybe they're suffering from, you know, an actual neurological disorder that, you know, between medication therapy, and they're all set, right? And they're cured. And you know, that after that, they're good, productive citizens. And if, you know, if they want to own a firearm and then they're not abusive, yeah, they can get it back. So there's the difference.
Pam?
And the confiscation. So even the temporarily withholding of firearms also gives room for quiet and clarity for a survivor to plan an escape. You know, we also have to kind of remember, again, when people escape from dangerous relationships, and this is only in the realm of domestic violence, not the other issues that this pertains to also. Only in the realm of dating domestic violence, people don't break up and move on. They escape, and we increase their chances of being murdered by 75%. So if we remove the access to weapons, it might allow a person to kind of stop, drop, and roll to figure out how the escape's going to look like. You know, some people come into shelter, our Willow Emergency Shelter, and their children are still able to go to their schools, and the person's still able to go to work. They're just not safe at their home at night. Some people come into our shelter and cannot leave it. And we work with other domestic violence agencies around the United States to relocate people whose danger levels are so high. So again, any temporary aid or any permanent aid to a survivor is absolutely wonderful, as long as they're the ones making the decisions on how that's going to work. I've supported survivors in the past, and I've said, are there firearms in the house? And they'll say yes. And I'll say, you have the personal right to go and apply for an order of protection. And if you choose to do that, you can mention that there's firearms in the house. And they say, if I do, and their guns get taken away, my family is going to be in greater danger just by that act alone. So again, what works over here might not work over here.
Okay. So. And Gary, what do you think the chances are of the extreme risk protection order passing this year?
I don't know if this year it will pass, but, you know, again, you know, you and many in the audience are very familiar with the legislative process. Sometimes these things take a few sessions to get through. I would love to see it get passed. Again, we're hopeful and optimistic because, again, a group of senators have proposed that this is part of a package, and it's something that hasn't happened in the past. I think that there's a certain sense of urgency now because of the national political climate that we need to do this and we need to act.
All right. There are some other items on their list they'd like to see passed, and we're also going to talk about where Gary thinks concealed carry may be going. So there are some issues related to gun legislation, and we will continue that conversation as we go forward with Gary Puttup from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence and Pam Graham, Prevention, Education, and Training Manager at Willow Domestic Violence Center. It's all coming up on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with the Democratic candidate for Monroe County Sheriff this year. It's Todd Baxter, the former Grease Police Chief and the former executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center. He wants the top job in Monroe County. He says it's a community in crisis, and he wants new leadership in law enforcement. So what would he do in the job? We'll sit down with Todd Baxter next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we get back to state legislation, there's been some talk about concealed carry, I think on the national level. And Gary Puttup, what are you hearing about that right now on concealed carry?
Well, right now in the House, there's a proposal to have mandated concealed carry reciprocity. And what that would mean is that every state would be mandated to recognize the pistol permit issued by any other state. Now, there are some states, for instance, like Utah, where you can get a pistol permit and it allows you to carry it in about, I think it's somewhere between 17 and 26 different states. Florida is the same way. In New York State, you have to be a New York State resident. You have to get a New York State permit, and New York State only recognizes the New York State pistol permit. Now, there are people in New York, and I can tell you, myself included, that have Utah permits and Florida permits to carry in other states. And the problem with this is that, and I'll use Utah as an example, is you never have to have been to Utah to get a Utah pistol permit. You can take a class here in Rochester. They do a background check, which I'll give them that. It is recertified as New York's now is every 5 years under the SAFE Act. The problem is, and I'm not, you know, pointing out Utah, but there are states, and this ties into the domestic violence issue. There are states that will issue concealed carry permits for people that have been actually convicted of domestic violence crimes, and they're still allowed to get a pistol permit. And what would happen is in New York State would have to, it would be mandated to recognize that permit. And it actually gets worse than that. There's actually a provision in the law that prevents police officers, when they encounter somebody with an out-of-state permit, to actually question the validity of the permit. They have to accept it on prima facie that it's a valid permit and that it hasn't been revoked or in effect. So basically what you're saying is anybody from any state, and including situations where people have abused women, will be allowed to carry a concealed weapon in Rochester. You know, we think that's just a really bad idea.
Pam?
Yeah, it all comes down to the laws, right? And the laws that are enforceable. And what we've kind of found and what we hear from survivors, as we learn from our survivors we support on a daily basis, is really there's more laws to protect a person who's abusive than there are to protect survivors of this crime. Mm-hmm. And that's the dangerous part.
All right, let me grab our first phone call, and this is Richard in Penfield. Go ahead, Richard.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my perspective this afternoon on your discussion is that I believe that the gun rights issue is very similar to the abortion issue in this country. And while your groups have wonderful names like Center for Gun Violence, and, you know, domestic abuse, I think their agenda is very much like the people who are trying to push a pro-life agenda in this country by removing the freedoms that were guaranteed in the Constitution or that everyone seems to assume a woman's body is her own. And they're doing it quietly and in smaller steps. And I'm a little nervous about this, and it bothers me. And the callers, the people who are in your panel today, remind me of the people that protest outside of a Planned Parenthood clinic that will intimidate people not to seek that treatment. What these people are trying to do, and trust me, it's not all bad what they're trying to do, but it is so generalized and it is such a broad brush upon everybody in our society that I think that it's a very detrimental path that they're going down as a way to restrict the rights of the United States citizens.
All right, so Richard, let me just follow up with one question for you, because I don't think I fully understand your concern. Is it that you think, when you say it's generalized, that this is sort of a Trojan horse for wider confiscation and the restriction of gun ownership rights for more Americans?
I absolutely do, because okay. Some of the things that they're pointing out is that if you have a history of domestic violence, that you're not entitled to carry or possess a firearm in New York State. If you're a convicted felon, you have that same restriction. So why not work as a lobbyist in order to get the executive branch of this state to enforce the laws that are currently on the books, to gain resources in order to make those laws more enforceable, rather than passing more and more legislation that really is a broad brush restriction type program.
Okay. Richard, hang there for a second. Thanks for the phone call. Gary, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think we're doing this quietly. I mean, I'm on your show, you know.
No, but I think what he's saying is you may say this is about targeting a small portion of the population that is dangerous, but his concern is kind of the slippery slope, the broader impact, and eventually more confiscation. Is there like a broader goal that's kind of subversive here, but the goal is broader confiscation?
Well, let me point this out again. And, you know, we talked about this the first half of the show. We're dealing with a situation where two people, police officers or the victims, have to go before a judge. There's a judicial review. So you have the checks and balances of two branches of government to get this. So that there's this oversight and judicial review. So I don't see how at all that is somehow secretive or, you know, some kind of backhanded way to take away other people's rights. And again, I would make clear in this, the respondent in these cases always has the right at the court to answer the petition. Once the situation is resolved, they can petition the court to get their guns back. And there's a sunset clause in this so that after a year's time, they're able to get their firearms back anyway. So I can't agree with Richard in that this is somehow, you know, again, the slippery slope, or this is somehow, you know, some kind of permanent, some kind of permanent infringement of somebody's rights.
Okay.
And I think we do have to keep in mind, too, like, I mean, there's a certain part of me that says, you know, a man that raises his hand and punches a woman, I'm sorry, you just shouldn't have a gun. That just doesn't make any sense. So I understand. I understand. And again, you know, I mean, I'm a gun owner. I belong to gun clubs. I have my pistol permit. But boy, you know what? If I strike a woman, yeah, you know, I think society does have the ability. No rights are absolute. And under those circumstances, yeah, sure, somebody that hits a woman, somebody that takes advantage of a vulnerable person, yeah, they probably shouldn't have a gun.
All right, let me ask Richard if he wants to follow up there. Go ahead, Richard.
I guess my comment would be nobody in the right mind would have a position against what your speaker just stated. But are there not already restrictions and consequences for a domestic abuser that they will lose their right to possess a firearm if convicted or if under an order of protection? These things already exist. Why do we need new legislation to enforce what I believe is already out there on the books in this state?
You know what, Richard? That's a fair question, and this is exactly why we're doing this. Understand your position. I'm sorry, it's a little clearer to me now. You know, and very often, and I don't mean this might sound worse or bad, and I don't mean it to sound bad. You know, having been in law enforcement for 30 years and worked, you know, even in the legal field and issues after my retirement, you know, I always ask, when I hear people say, just enforce the laws that are on the books, I always ask, what state laws that are on the books that are not being enforced? I mean, I don't know of any district attorney or any police officer that's turning a blind eye to violations, whether it's domestic violence or in gun laws. I don't see this happening. But to get at the core of, I think, what your concern is the reason we're doing this is because there are no laws, there are no provisions right now. As I think I stated earlier, the issue with the order of protection is it's reactive. It's a situation where after an abuse, after a physical attack, the guns can be taken. What this is allowing someone to do is the family member, household, law enforcement, to connect the dots prior to that incident, prior to somebody being victimized and saying, there's a situation here that we want the court to be aware of. The court can look at that, has to look at sworn testimony and evidence and saying, yes, this is an issue, and this person probably shouldn't have guns during this period of time.
Okay, Richard, one more follow-up if you want.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Oh, very good. I certainly appreciate it, Richard. And by the way, Gary, I think his questions were good ones, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, he is asking the question, why are we, you know, it's a good question.
Every time there's new legislation.
Why do we want this new legislation? Yeah. And that's a fair and legitimate question.
No question.
And I think we have
the
answer.
Yeah, thank you. And Pam, I know you want to weigh in too.
Yeah, it just, Ashley, I mean, I could understand, given the subject today, how it would be very easy to say that there's 4,000 different agendas everybody has to be talking about it. And I just would kind of really like to clarify that Willow Domestic Violence Center does not have an agenda. It has an actual mission. And our mission is really to cue in on the prevention piece, that our mission is to prevent domestic violence and to ensure that every survivor has access to the services and supports needed in the journey to a safe and empowered life. So our mission at Willow, working with survivors who are at greater risk because of guns, right, and the access to guns, is purely safety planning and figuring out what that person needs to be safe in that moment. So again, the gun piece is a piece of it. There's a whole bunch of other risk factors going into that, and we purely have a mission to support the personal rights of our community, which is to have a healthy relationship, and anything less than that's not okay.
Now, if I could just...
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
Evan, if I could just add one thing, and, you know, and I'll ask Pam for her opinion on this too, is that, you know, it's like with crime, and we hear about crime, we hear about domestic violence, domestic abuse, domestic situations. It's not as if these are disproportionately American problems or problems only in the United States. The rates of domestic violence, the rates of crime in other developed countries are just as high as they are here in the United States. But why are we losing 11 times more women? It's because of the presence of the firearm. You know, we know this, and like Pam said before, this is preventable. And it's the type of thing, it's a really easily preventable. And if it saves these women's lives, it's something we should be doing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, out of the domestic violence homicides, again, 73% of those murders are inflicted by intimate partners who use handguns.
73%.
73% of those murders.
All right, back to the phones. Dan in Brighton. Go ahead, Dan.
If a woman hits a man first, is the man entitled to hit the woman back? At least not as hard as he can, but at least somewhat?
So when we start looking at that, there should be no types of abuse that are okay at all. So under dangerous relationships, verbal abuse, name-calling, put-downs, harsh tone of voice, the emotional abuse stuff, threatening to harm self, there can be economic abuse, sexual abuse, even including unwanted comments about partners' bodies. Physical abuse is where the cycle of abuse ends, and it shouldn't be happening to anybody. What we know about, again, 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men can be victims of dating or domestic violence, and it absolutely should not be happening on any level at all. And that if something has increased in frequency and escalated to the violence, that it's ending at physical abuse, everybody has a right to be safe. And there won't ever be a reason that it's okay for anybody to be physically abused.
Yeah, and to add, this proposed legislation is gender neutral, and it does recognize that, yeah, there are men that are abused at the hands of women. However, the fact remains, and you know, and as Pam has so eloquently pointed out with some of the data she has, but that so many women, you know, if this was a 50-50 thing, you know, like 50% of the victims of, you know, domestic violence and of homicides were men and 50% were women, okay, maybe there's something else at play here. But the fact of the matter is this is a problem where women are especially vulnerable and disproportionately the victims.
You want to follow up on that, Dan?
No, they've answered my questions. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate that, Dan. Listeners, you want to weigh in on this as we continue our discussion on potential new gun legislation? It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Looking at safe storage and Nicholas's law, that's something that has come up here. Gary, why don't we talk a little bit about what that is and where you think it might be going?
Well, safe storage or Nicholas's law is a bill that's been introduced and has passed the Assembly. I believe it's for three years now. And the name comes from a young man named Nicholas Numkin from the Saratoga region of the North Country. One of Nicholas's friends, a 12-year-old boy, had found a loaded handgun in his home and was playing with Nicholas and shot and killed Nicholas Numkin. And there are some municipalities, actually the city of Rochester is one, the city of New York, and the city of Buffalo, that have safe storage provisions. That is if a gun is not in your immediate possession or control, it has to be locked up. We recently, last year, were involved with getting such a law passed in the city of Albany. And in our research and looking into that is what we were finding in the city of Albany, which is smaller than the city of Rochester, a handgun was being stolen out of a car once every 10 days in the city of Albany. And it's not unusual sometimes for, like, a gun owner to come, like, downtown Rochester. And they're not allowed to take their handguns, like, say, into the Blue Cross Arena or, you know, some of the municipal, but like the City Hall. I believe they're allowed in the county office building, but that's another story. But so what they'll do is they'll leave their guns in their cars. And sometimes people will, like, just be visiting and leave their guns, just under the seat of the car or in the unlocked glove box. And with this, in the Democrat and Chronicle not long ago, I think it was in the last month, there was a vehicle where kids were going through cars at night. You know, they do that thing where they go from driveway to driveway just going through cars, and somebody had left their handgun in their car or in their pickup truck, excuse me, and it was taken. Well, that gun's out on the street now. And not only is that a danger to the general public, it could be a danger to, you know, if this is like some 15 or 16-year-old, you know, he can end up shooting himself, one of his friends with it, and then you always have, you know, the problem with, you know, police officers stopping, you know, on a vehicle stop, and now we have this gun out there. Well, what would it require gun owners to do is keep their guns locked up. You know, if you want to throw it in a car, there are many, you know, cheap and inexpensive ways to do that. And you can go to any of the local sporting goods stores, and for less than $20, buy a nice safe that you can actually keep in the car or in your home. And it's the same thing. You know, burglaries can be a problem when guns aren't locked up at home.
But hold on.
Yep.
My brain goes back to the Jim Jefferies monologue, the Australian comedian who did 15 minutes on American gun culture, and it went viral. And this is where Jim Jefferies makes a point. And as a gun owner yourself, Gary, I want to know if you agree with him. He says the idea that we've got to put guns in a safe, if it's at our home, for example, wherever it is, means that we can no longer use them for protection. That if someone breaks into your house, you don't get to say to them, excuse me while I go over and what was the combination on the safe again? Just give me one moment here. 34 to the right, 28 to the left, and now I'm going to fish this thing out and use it. He says that defeats the entire purpose and that you can't say that you're using it for protection at that point. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I've seen that, and it's funny.
Is there a point there?
No.
And no?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because if you're keeping it in a safe with a combination safe, and I have one of those for my guns at home, you're right. I mean, I'm going to have to get up and do that. That said, all one needs to do is like Google, instant access safes. There are safes that are made that are actually biometric. You could literally stick your finger in front of the safe, and it will open for you once you program it.
Okay.
There's also safes that will have, like, and you've seen these, the 3 or 4 button combinations where you just press down the buttons in a particular sequence. And I'm going to offer this. I understand what he's saying, and again, it's as a stand-up comic, it's funny. The fact of the matter is, if somebody was really of the mindset that they felt that they needed a gun by next to their bedside, for the home invasion, which again is very rare, but that's okay. If that's how they feel and that's what they want, these things are not that expensive, especially when you compare them to the cost of a gun and ammunition.
The safe.
And they're easily accessed.
Okay.
In addition to that, there's a certain argument to be made. Like if you hear a noise in the night, there's plenty of cases where, parents have shot their children coming home late, wives have shot their husbands coming home late, or coming in maybe, some manner they shouldn't have. But, it actually gives the homeowner a few seconds to get themselves together. I mean, how many times have you even, woken up and the idea that you're fully aware of your surroundings?
Sure.
Right? So it gives you a little time. So, it makes for good stand-up comedy. Realistically, it's not the case. And again, there's plenty of alternatives there for the person that does feel that they want to have the gun for self-protection.
We've got a couple minutes left. Some final thoughts from Pam Graham from Willow Domestic Violence Center when we talk about ways forward here. Willow is not a political organization.
No,
and it shouldn't be a political issue protecting women. But generally speaking here, what do you want to see happen to make sure, well, not just women, but people are protected, especially in domestic violence situations?
Just that we all recognize that every dangerous relationship has its own danger level based on the abuser in it, and that guns could very well be a piece of that and are. And that's what we know. And that there is an expert when it comes to the domestic violence piece, and it's the survivor who's going through it. Only they know how bad and how dangerous their intimate partner are. So I just want to invite anybody today to know that from this day forward, no one is alone in the domestic violence piece. We have a 24-hour hotline, 232-7353. People can call 24/7. We have safe shelter. We have people in court, and we have one-on-one counseling. So nobody should be alone in figuring out their safety plan in all of this.
Thank you, Pam. And Gary, when I look at the New Yorkers Against Gun Violence legislative priorities, we talked in detail about two. There's a number of them. What could pass this year? What do you think has a real shot to pass this year?
Actually, I think the emergency risk does have a shot to pass because of what this deals with. And let's keep in mind, in the United States, a woman is shot and killed in a domestic violence situation once every 8 hours. By the time you and I woke up this morning, and by the time we go to bed tonight, two women will have died, by gunfire in domestic situations. When we wake up tomorrow, we will have lost 3 more. The point is this is wholly preventable. It doesn't need to happen. And if we were losing any other demographic or any other group at this rate, we would have been acting long ago. And this is long overdue, and I think it could pass.
I want to thank our guests for coming in, and we'll keep you updated on this as we continue to go forward in the legislative session. Gary Puttup with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Always nice, Gary. Thank you for coming on the program
today. Well, thank you, Evan.
And Pam Graham, Prevention, Education, and Training Manager at Willow Domestic Violence Center. Pam, thank you very much for being
thank
here
you.
As well. You want to do that phone number one more time? I challenge you on
yes,
that
yes, 585-232-7353. Thank you, Evan.
232-7353 to call Willow. Let's get a short break, and much more Connections is next.